Okay.
This week's parsha, parsha Vayigash. It's one of my favorites, maybe even my favorite, maybe. My favorite shmooz that I give, and I try to give it over the course of every year if I can at some point in time to deliver a similar shmooz to this one. Okay. This is like the soap opera coming to a conclusion. Is it on or not? Crazy story of Yosef and his brothers. We've experienced like the trials, tribulations. We watched the game play out. We're on the side of Yosef. We're watching from Yosef's angle. The brothers are questioning and wondering what's happening in our lives. They're frustrated. We're accused of being spies. We're not spies. Locked up in jail. Then Shimon is kept behind. And finally, they let go. They find their money's all in their bags again. And they can't figure out who put the money back. There's question after question going on. And Yosef is playing them. He's manipulating the situation in a way that's like, it's unbelievable. He's got this thing under his control. And he gets Binyamin back here, and then he sets up Binyamin for the kill, and he puts the goblet in his cup, and finally, this week's parsha, we have the climax. The moment that Yosef comes clean and tells the brothers who he is, and we're waiting for like that moment, that unbelievable, slap in the face of those boys, and he's been waiting for 22 years for this spot. And sure enough, it happens. Yehuda comes along, and Yehuda comes to his brother, and he says, listen, right now, where we have it right now, just to catch us up, Binyamin's been locked up in jail forever. He's locked up in jail. And Yehuda has to defend. He promised his father that he would not let Binyamin go. And here's Binyamin. He's stuck in jail in Mitzrayim right now. And he comes to defend. And he pleads with his brother. He says, you don't understand. I made a deal. And he reads the Chumash. It's moving. He would win an Academy Award for his performance of begging Yosef, the viceroy of Mitzrayim, let him go. Let me take his place instead. I'll read the words inside to you. He goes through the whole story. He says, you know, you asked me, do we have a father, brother? I said, yeah, we have an older father and a little boy. His brother's dead and all he has left is him. And you said, bring him down here. And we said, we can't. His father loves him too much. And he said, you don't come down, you get no more food. And now what am I going to do? My father says, get more food. I said, we can't get more food. We need the boy. They say, we won't let us go. And the father says, no, we can't get more food if you don't give us the boy. So finally he said, okay, you can take it. But just so you know, if something happens to him, I'll be broken. And now he says, finally, he says, Vata kivoi el abdecha avi. Imagine now what's going to happen. I go back to my father. Is Yehuda talking? Vanana and Nitanu, and the Nar is not with us. I lost Binyamin. They're kindred spirits. Game over. He's dead. My father will not survive. And then he says, one more pasuk is up here. He says, I made a deal. I can't let my father cease his pain like this. Let me take his place. The final pasuk of this parak. How can I ever go back to see my father's face again? Lest this bad that found us will hit my father, and who knows what could happen to my dad in the end. To plead. He's begging. I'll take his place. We can't have this. I promised. I made a deal. And Yosef is going to come clean right now. And you'd expect like vicious words. Fire. This is it. 22 years of my life I lost. I've been locked up in a foreign country. I haven't seen my dad for 22 years because of you. This should be the biggest rebuke. And I have Chazal say, actually, the rebuke Yosef gives is so potent and powerful. It's so dynamic and painful for the brothers. They can't speak afterwards. Their mouths are shut. And Abba Kohen Bardla is one of the one we have. He discusses that this rebuke that we have that Yosef said to the brothers is a rebuke that we're getting Shemayim one day. The same rebuke in Shemayim. And for the fact that the brothers couldn't answer their brother, the younger brother, he gives a famous saying, "Oy lanu miyom hadin." Woe is to us on our day of judgment. Woe is to us on our day of rebuke. If the little brother Yosef can act that way and the brothers are dumbfounded by what he says, what happens to us when we go in front of God after 120 years? And he gives us a hard time. We're like, and we can't speak. So let's figure out just what Yosef said to his brothers. What's the rebuke going to be for us? Because the same rebuke. It's a parallel rebuke. We're going to have the same thing happen to us and God 120 years, 100 years, 102 years from now. For you boys, I got less time. I got only 81 to go. Listen to the words. Vayomer Yosef Elachav. Yosef said to his brothers the following line, this dagger of a line. Ani Yosef. Ha'od avi chai? Question mark. And they couldn't respond. Five words. I'm Yosef. Is dad still alive? Okay, I understand they're surprised. They didn't know it was Yosef. It's shocking. But why would Chazal say, and contained in that those five words, is a rebuke that you and I, we're in big trouble one day. Those five words, I'll take that rebuke. Thank you very much. God, I'm God. You know, how's your kid doing? Fine, thanks for asking. That's it, I'm done. Sounds pretty good. I'll get up pretty nicely on that one. Because I'll say, no, that's the worst. That's the worst. What's so bad about that? I'm going to give you four different ideas, Shatim, to understand what's so bad about this. And each one is less, more painful than the other one to hear. And it's going to be like, you got to figure out what we're going to do when the day comes, based on these Shatim. First one is the Netziv. The Netziv is the following pshat. He says, Ha'od avi chai. Is my father still alive? You know, you can look at me however you want to look at me. You can look at me whichever way you want. You know, you think I'm guilty of doing certain things wrong when I was younger. I hear that. I respect your decision. But my father, he loved me the most of anyone else. Did you understand the ramifications that the actions would have on my dad? Do you think about that at all? Imagine you take someone to fight with someone else and you do something wrong with them. You hit them, you punch them, you got somebody, someone killed someone else. They deserved it. But did their wife deserve it? Did their kid deserve it? You want to judge me, you want to be mean to me, okay, I hear that. But how about my father? You love him so much. You killed him. You destroyed his life. 22 years, he can't get over it. Do you understand the damage that you've caused? You think your action was an isolated event? Oftentimes you'll go and you hear someone who goes to court. And when they're being sentenced, they'll bring their little kids with them in the court. Why? You imagine they want to shelter their kids from watching their father being sentenced to jail. Because everyone knows, look at these poor little kids. That means their father's going away for life. You want to do it to the kids? Think about what it means to them a little bit. I don't know if it works or doesn't work at all. But it's a theory. It's an idea in order to protect the guy from being sentenced to jail for longer. Because what are your actions going to mean? What ripple effect do your actions actually have? We have no idea. You do a small little action, a small little thing. Just a small thing, you think to yourself. You have no idea where that leads to in the end. For good and for bad. And you take things so haphazardly in life. I'm going to go out to town, just one time. I'll do this action, I'll just do it one time only. I'll make this one mistake. It's okay, it's one mistake out of the whole body of work that I have in life. You have no clue the damage that will be done by that one body of work. I was recently reading about last week a Bill Simmons article about the Cleveland Browns. When did their their franchise turn to pot, basically? And he went through and he had a Muscon. It was like in 1980. I forget exactly the story he had. Remember the article? I forget which. But he had like a moment. That moment he said that deflated. They were done after that moment. Now that moment was like it was a game where they failed to protect a very big lead. I don't forget what that was. It was some mistake that they made. One game. He said that was it. What do you mean? It was one small game. No, that changed the course of their entire franchise. I mean, I'm thinking it's a little silly the whole thing about a franchise, but you can pinpoint sometimes an action that at the time looks so innocent that ruins you in the end. It ruins you. People always point, I mentioned beforehand, people always point to the Red Sox comeback of the Yankees. Dave Robert Steele was that moment that was the series changer. At the time, they were so behind and they were probably going to lose the game. And the Vegas odds would have went up only slightly, they were going to win the series. Very slightly. But that was the game-changing play. Almost every game that you play, whenever you watch the game at the end, they always have the game-changing moment in the game. No one knew at the time that was going to be the game changer. No one knew that. It happened to have worked out that way. Says the Netziv, the rebuke to the brothers was, you don't understand when you do an action what kind of ripple effect that it has. Same thing to us now. Picture, we go to Shemayim one day. Let's take the Mussar now to us. Go to Shemayim one day. Because Rav Chaim here says, why you struggle in this area over here? Because you made a single decision in life that forever changed the course of your life. You thought it was small. I'll give you, I'm not at all pushing this right now. I forgive me for doing it, but we talked about this a little bit today with some guys in Seder. Imagine the following scene. Imagine this discussion of staying 1 year in Israel over 2 years in Israel. I don't mean to bring this up. I'm not pitching it right now. I will later, but not now. Imagine, you think to yourself, well, what's the big deal? I'll learn also when I'm home. I have good friends going with me also there. I make an innocent decision. It's a single decision in life, innocent decision. And you make a move that makes you go to a certain place in life right now, and you're not ready for it maybe. Or even if you think you are ready for it, but there's so much more you can't accomplish right now. And that will forever, I say this without question, will forever determine your path in life from this point forward. You had a crossroad, and you chose that way. Whichever way you chose, it's life-altering. It's not a minor decision. Oh, it's okay, I'll still have a chavrusa. I'm okay. I'll still go to Minyan. That's called an excuse. Doesn't mean it could be the right move for you. It could be the right move. But don't belittle the decision you're making right now. The ripple effect of your decisions that you make in life are drastic. And I'm sure many of you, even being in Israel for the year, maybe some of you even were thinking about coming, to come to Israel for the year is drastic. And think about what if you hadn't come. Look at your friends who you're close with who didn't go to Israel for the year. Drastic differences. Switching a yeshiva, the midstream even. Even switching a shiur, switching anything that you do, it has drastic ramifications. Are you sure that's the right move for you right now? You're positive? Because you're not going to be able to say to God one day, I didn't know. That's the mussar. You have to know. You have to play the lesson that says, mussar is, my father didn't deserve the pain. Maybe I did, but he didn't deserve the pain. Therefore, you can't give me the pain because it hits him also. Shot number one. Chavetz Chaim, shot number two. The brothers, back to the brothers, I'll get to us in a minute. The brothers are wondering, they have no idea what's going on for the last number of years. They don't get it. We're accused inappropriately of being spies. We're not spies. We know we're not spies. We found money in our bag. It makes no sense to be there at all. He asked about our brother. We told him about Binyamin. We go back again. Plants the goblet in there. Takes Binyamin. This makes no sense. I have thousands of questions. I'm not okay with anything happening now. The world is crazy. Craziness. And all of a sudden, in two words, every single question is answered. Two words. I'm Yosef. And then it hits them. You know, you ever see the movie Usual Suspects? Anyone? Usual Suspects? Yeah. There was a scene, this guy is basically making a tale, he's fabricating a whole entire story, and all of a sudden he snaps and he realizes there was just, he saw one name or whatever it was that clicked everything in there, and the entire, as the cup falls to the ground and smashes, his mug he was holding, and smashes, he realized the entire story, what really happened. I won't say what happened. Every single thing that he was hearing about, it all finally clicked in at the very end. He didn't understand till then, though. Imagine you're living a life that you're so understanding, you're so confident what's happening, until finally, and so I should say that, you have no idea what's happening. The world makes no sense to you at all. I have thousands of questions. And I says, and Yosef. And all of a sudden, the brother's like, that explains everything. And they couldn't respond. They were dumbfounded by the clarity they had right now. You go through life, you have so many questions, and they're all good questions. Why did this Nebuch thing happen to this person that I care about so much? How come what I wanted so badly to work out just didn't fly in the end? Question after question, why did this person get sick, this person passed away, this person didn't go married, divorce, so many questions. And we may even accuse God of being not right in life. It's not right, it's not fair, it makes no sense to me at all. Bichlal, I want to reject you, God. You live, you're running a terrible system over here. You go to Shemayim and God says, Ani Hashem. And you're like, epiphany. What? Why didn't you say so beforehand? It all makes so much sense right now. And then every single question you had is a perfect fit. Maybe down here you don't like it, but up there you're going to understand so clearly. But we can't see it. We get so fixated in our little world that we live in, we miss the boat so much. I'll give you a muscle for that, of missing the boat. Imagine one time, you know, you're on a date with a very cultured girl. And you want to show our culture. You want to take her to, the Louvre in France, in Paris. And you go, you're looking at all the Mona Lisa, and you say, wow, look at that painting. And she's thinking to herself, whoops. I thought this guy was like uncultured. Look at him. He's finally coming along. I'm teaching him. And you're admiring all the colors and the way that's put together. And she's like, wow, like, you know, this could work after all. And you go to the girl in the end, like, that frame is really something else, isn't it? Look at that frame. Like, unbelievable how they put it together. See yourself, the frame? That frame is $50? You're looking at a $500,000 painting and you look at the frame? What are you, a fool? And she leaves you, you know, and goes out with the guy who runs the museum and marries him later on. You're sitting there appreciating the frame that, you know, that makes you look like a loser. In life, how often are we sitting there admiring a frame? What a beautiful frame that is. We're so focused on things that are so ridiculous in life. I mentioned this morning to our Tobias, you're walking by gold mines. You're making decisions that are so out to lunch. I want to start life. Where are you running to? So you can do what? You can get a job quicker, make more money quicker, retire quicker, and then what? And then what? And then die. That's what happens. That's what life cycle is. And then what? What are you running to? You're put here not to make money. It's important. It's not why you're put here. You're put here to figure out a way to perfect yourselves. You forgot. You look at the you see a painting and you see a frame. And it's such a cool frame. And I can't see the painting. You're so unsophisticated. But at some point in time, it's going to hit you. And it might be too late then. Might be already when you're up there already. On the Hashem. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, can I have a second chance? And the answer is no. Ani Yosef is the moment when they realize that everything that they thought to be true, it just was not. Their whole world vision they had and their glasses on were wrong. It was the wrong prescription. Now what? They were zochah to hear, but what happens when you and I hear when it's too late? So then what? We spend so much of our lives focusing on things that don't matter at all. And we're so fixed and we get so angry about it. Intramural basketball and a back call. The rep. Who cares? Who cares? It's worth cursing for that? It's worth arguing for that? Losing your mitos? Who cares? Even you don't care. In a week from now, you won't even care. Okay, maybe money you care about beyond a week, but in the end, you won't care about that either. Because, you know, it doesn't matter at all. It's not important in life. What's important in life is that you work on yourself to become better people. Ani Yosef, Ani Hashem. Wake up and realize what's important in life. Don't be so fixated on where am I going to next, where am I running to next. Stop with next. Right now you're here. Stick it out here. Work on it here. Become better here and see where life takes you. Stop with your plans and have so much vision for yourself. Those are good at some point in time, but not right now. Come the time right now. Maybe you'll have a different picture. The glasses will change. Ani Yosef, Ani Hashem. Shot number 3. This is one of most people's favorite ones. My second favorite one. Most people's favorite one, though. It's the Beis Halevi. Famous shot, Beis Halevi gives. Beis Halevi suggests the following chiddush. Imagine, once again, we'll role play the brothers again. Yosef, here's Yehuda. Yosef, do you understand what this means? Do you understand what my father's going to be feeling like? You're going to want to cause my father pain like this? He might not survive this, he says to Yosef. Yosef is moved. Wow. It's a moving story, and I feel terrible about this. I'm sorry. It's one problem I have with your story, though. I'm Yosef. Did my father survive all the care you have right now? Did he survive when you took me away? Did he survive that also? You're such a caring brother, Yehuda. You're so caring. It was you who said, sell me. It was you. Oh, you're so, all of a sudden, you're this caring older brother, doting younger brother, lest your father feel pain? Tell someone else who knows the true story of what happened to us. Tell someone else that story. And the brothers are shot down because they themselves are their worst enemy right now. Because they lied. Because their own actions show that they lied. They weren't really what they thought they were. Because in the end of the day, that same thing happened 22 years earlier. And Yehuda sold Yosef. And how's dad doing? He still made it through? He made it through? He'll make it through this one too, by the way. Your story is a joke. How do you respond to that? What do we do with us? Imagine the following scene. Here we are. Go to Shemayim one day. God says to us, you know, you didn't get so much stucco. He says, listen, God, with all due respect, tough times were tough. You know that. You know, I got fired once or twice. Market was difficult. I invested. God says, you know what? I know those things. I know. You're right. Was that you that took that 2-week trip to Europe with your family? Was that you? Because that was you, that I'm not sure how you can tell me the times were so tough in the end of the day. Your actions, your own acts that you worked so hard on, those actions, I think those actions are going to do you in the end. You can't sit here and give me an excuse as to why you couldn't, why you weren't able to. Someone says over here, you know, it's Gemara, it's so hard. It's so hard for me. I don't get it. I can't do Gemara. I can't do Gemara. I respect that. It says, God, one second. Didn't you major in a very difficult in astrophysics when you were in college? That's a pretty hard topic. You worked really hard for that. You know that? You studied hours upon hours. You pulled it off in the end. You could do this also. No, Rebbe, I was so tired. I couldn't go to Seder today. I couldn't go. Weren't you the same guy when Papa Giles was on the line? You pushed yourself so you had some extra hours in there? That was you? I'm sorry then. Your comment you make to me that you couldn't keep up with it. You weren't feeling so great. You do it for everything else that you want to do it for. You don't do it for me? When your behavior, your actions are your worst enemy, because it shows it's not really true in the end. I'll tell you a quick story with this, and then I'll get to my last point. And as always, we'll do a shorter davening. There was this Rav Nachum Persavitz, written in a book called Sunset. Rav Blavatsky's father-in-law, Rav Chanoch Teller, wrote this book. So this Rav Nachum, who was in the Mir Yeshiva, had a student of his who was an unbelievable student. A masmid utzim, a tremendously diligent scholar. And he was in the yeshiva for years. After a few years in the yeshiva, he told his Rebbe, Rav Nachum, I have to go home now back to America. I have to see my family and, you know, look for get married and you know, have a career. This student, just so you know, a little background, was very diligent, but he had 1 week because he couldn't get up in the morning for a minute. He wasn't able to. It was just very hard. He was up until 3 in the morning every night, and he would wake up at 9. He missed a minute, he'd stop by himself. Whatever. He's not proud of it. That's what he was. Sure enough, the Rebbe goes to the student and says to the student, what time is your flight tomorrow? So my flight's at, I think I wake up at 4 in the morning to catch my flight. He was like, 4 in the morning, okay. He's like, Tzlacha, you know, we should have a safe trip, etc. Student walks out, Rav Nachum breaks into tears. 4 in the morning? Oh no. What if he gets up in the morning first thing to catch his flight? What's going to happen to Shemayim one day? His excuse is gone. God, I was so tired, I couldn't do it. But he did it to catch his flight. So Rav Nachum davened. Because Baruch Hu, please, I'm begging you, let this man sleep through his alarm clock. Let him miss his flight. I don't want him to go to Shemayim one day and have to explain to God how come he could pull this off and he couldn't pull that off. And sure enough, he missed his alarm clock, he slept through his flight. Rav Nachum the next day was the happiest person in the world. Because when you live your life in a way that's not true, and you make excuses to yourself or to God one day, he'll just put in the video of your life and play, and he'll say to you, what? That's what you're saying? But I thought you said to me that you couldn't do that, but you did a fine job over there. And then you're done. What are you going to do? The last answer. This will stop. It's a Shem Yishmuel. Shem Yishmuel brings down Sakhat Shavar Rebbe that the rebuke that Yosef gave his brothers was no rebuke at all. He didn't say a word to them. Do you know why? Because when someone realizes how badly they messed up, you don't need to tell them anything. It's the most painful thing in the world, and nothing you say to them would matter at all. You're like, you eat, and you know that you want someone to scream at you. Scream at me, please scream at me. Let me be Yotzei my punishment. Just tell me, just do it. You know, hit me. Yeah. The fact that I hit you, it kills you even more. You want it, just deal with me already. It kills you when they don't do that. It eats you alive. The fact that Yosef didn't say a word, on Yosef, Odebichai, and he says, and you guys are on your own to think about what should have been, what could have been in the end. And the brothers' minds racing of what could have, what should have, and how, oh my gosh. But they don't. Yosef doesn't say a word to them. He lets their mind race. There's nothing worse than realizing what could have been and what was in the end. I'll give you two sports mushels and one rabbi mushel, and then we'll stop. I grew up as a Georgetown Hoya basketball fan in the days of Alonzo Mourning, Patrick Ewing. And there was back in the day when the Georgetown Hoyas lost to the North Carolina Tar Heels, Michael Jordan had a nice like elbow baseline shot with 14 seconds left to win the game for the team. That's what everyone shows. That's the big shot that won the game. But the truth, something happened afterwards. There was a player named Freddie Brown, who was the point guard for the Georgetown Hoyas at the time. He never went past, you know, the college. Actually, eventually, later on, he became the junior varsity girls basketball coach at the Hebrew Academy, Greater Washington. That's how bad the story takes a turn. That's how he, not varsity and not even boys. JV girls assistant coach.
Very bad. Wow.
If you ever watched the highlight of that game with about 7 seconds left, he's dreaming the ball of the clock. He's at one last shot down by 1 point. And he turns and he passes it right to James Worthy, who's on the other team. And James was like, but he was like, it was almost there. And his ball dribbles out of the clock and the game's over. Now you'd imagine Freddie Brown, like the coach should like give him a knock on the head and be like, you fool! We practice together. That guy's on our team. What are you passing for? It's the last play of the game. That didn't happen. Almost every single collage you watch of college basketball, you'll see the following scene. John Thompson, not the one who's currently a coach, that's his son. John Thompson, this big 6'9" monster of a man who used to drape a towel over his shoulder. That was his signature look. Freddie Brown is like in shock at his move. And the coach goes over to him and gives him a bear hug. And he starts to break down and cry on his shoulder. He doesn't say a word to him. Freddie, that was the wrong guy. He doesn't even told that. He knows. In his mind, he played this scene out thousands of times. And he blew it. And he'll never get it back again. Imagine in your mind you have a single chance to live. And you waited your whole non-life to get a life. And here you are. You have a life now. And you've been playing this out while you were in a shama, hoping you make the right calls, and your life is just taking a different turn than you expected it to be. If you realize that, no one's saying you'll give you rebuke. Your understanding of how far you've fallen is rebuke enough. You're done. There was a basketball player for Arizona State Sun Devils named Hideki Smith, which no one ever heard of probably. Anybody ever heard of Hideki Smith? Anyone? Okay, look at later on. You can check it out later on. Hedake. About 20 years ago, must have been, he was one of the top point guards, supposed to be pretty high in the first round of the draft. And in the old days, they used to not go to, they didn't have the guy come to the draft line. They would actually sit with their friends, whatever room they were in, and they would have cameras filming them with their friends as they were picked. If someone called them, they phoned, they celebrated, etc. I think this was an excellent basketball player. He had a rumor at the end of his senior year that he was a point shaver. What that means is someone who gambles, there's a certain line the Vegas odds give who's going to win the game. He would never lose on purpose. But he would shave a point or two off to make the score closer, and he got paid a lot of money for doing so. A lot of money, $20,000, $25,000. It was a rumor, unconfirmed rumor. And as the draft went on, and everyone's sitting in the room waiting for his name to be called, first five picks, not called. There wasn't a big stretch, but the top 10 he should have been. 10 picks, name's not called. Top 20 picks, name's not called. The draft passed, and he was never picked. The NBA, they blacklisted him. Why? Because he took $25,000 of cash, he admitted it in the end, he did it, in order to shave some points off the game. Now imagine this guy. He's worked his whole life to be in the NBA, to make millions of dollars. And for a quick few bucks, he blew it. You don't need to tell that guy, Hideki, I think you made the wrong call on that one. He's pretty sure about that himself. He knows that. You don't need to tell him that. He lives with his life, the feeling that I blew it. I blew it. I ruined my life. I ruined my career. To this day, he's never recovered. He never made it. Because he made a mistake. Imagine, you don't need to tell him how big a mistake you made. And the rabbi's story, and this ends over here, last minute. There's a rabbi named Netziv, in Tel Yehuda, Berlin. Wrote many svarim. And when he wrote one of the svarim, he said, I want to tell you a story of the sefer over here. This sefer was written because something that happened when I was much younger. When I was younger, I was playing ball with my friends, and I was running by my house, catch the ball. I missed the ball, and I heard my parents crying. They were crying, they were saying, Naftali, gosh, he's just not going to make it. He doesn't learn, he doesn't sound serious at all. It kills me inside to see it. And he felt terrible. His parents, they cared so much. He ran to the room, he ran to the house, and says, Mom, Dad, I'm sorry, I'll work harder. Please don't cry, don't cry. And it moved him to watch how much his parents cared about him and how much they were bothered by what he did. And he committed his life afterwards to being careful and learning and growing and davening, and he grew into becoming the Netziv. And he wrote Svarim upon Svarim. He says, you know what would have happened if I hadn't remembered that one day? I would have died at whatever age I died at. I'd go to Shemayim one day. And they would pull up the red carpet drawn out for me. And I'd walk on the carpet wondering, who's this for? And they'd be blowing trumpets and horns, and all the rabbis would be dancing in front of me. The Netziv is here! I'm looking around me and be like, is someone else here named Netziv? Who's going on here? No, you're the Netziv! No. I'm not totally. I happen to be a carpenter. I'm a good guy. I give tzedakah. I give charity. I'm a do chesed. I'm not. No. You're the famous Netziv. And he doesn't know what's going on, but they bring it to a bookshelf, into a room of a sermon. You see on the shelf is the Emek Davar, the Emek Sheila, the Sheotos, all these sermon that he wrote on, everything that he commented on. And he says, what's going on here? And he says, look, open the book up. Page number one is his name. His name, his father's name, page on the book. Turn to the next page. They turn to the next page. It was empty. Nothing else written there. And everybody took every book on the shelf, and everyone had his name in it, and nothing was written on any other page. That was it. Could you imagine the busha? If I wouldn't have known how much my parents cared. I wouldn't have heard that conversation. I would have gone to Shemayim as a good guy. I would have gone to a bookshelf of non-written books. What a busha it would have been to see that happen. I'm the most thankful person in the world to have seen my life go a certain way and protect it before it was too late. The muster a person has when he realizes what could have been and what he did instead is tragic. Ani Yosef, you're on your own, guys. Figure out what that means for the last 20 years of your life. You thought I was a dreamer? I was a prophet. I wasn't a dreamer, I was a prophet. You thought I was trying to trick you? I wasn't trying to trick you. I was trying to inspire you. You do the math. You figure out yourself now what that means. The muster that's entailed in that is so severe. How many people in this room over here should be writing Sfarim one day? Should be taking a more serious nature in their religiosity, in their davening, in their commitment to life. Who's looking at the picture frame? Who's looking at the painting? We have X amount of years of life to figure this out. The brothers were given a gift they figured out in their lifetime. We should be zocher to take the gift the brothers were given and figure out how to apply it to our own lives.